Many people on both sides of the political aisle are filled with fear about the current state of our country. The solution, according to philosopher Martha C. Nussbaum, is to try to maintain the opposite of fear, hope.
It's sort of like seeing the glasses half full rather than half empty. It's a difference of perspective and emphasis, but it makes a huge difference.
Plus, Octavia Butler's book Kindred is one of the most powerful American novels. It first came out in 1979. Last year, it was adapted into an award-winning graphic novel.
Kindred is still, I think, very relevant because it's dealing with the fact that the wages of slavery, to a certain degree, are being kind of earned now.
We're talking about Kindred as well as the first Comic Book Studies Society conference that's happening in Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. University of Chicago philosopher Martha C. Nussbaum's work has explored the gamut of emotions, from love to shame to anger, and now fear. Her latest book looks at how fear is informing our politics and political discourse, and along the way, she also looks at emotions like disgust, anger, and envy, and how that relates to fear, and also how that affects our democracy. Even, for example, the rise in hate crimes. The book is called The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. It's just out this summer, and Martha's on the line with us from the University of Chicago. Hi, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, hi, Nyla. It's very nice of you to have me on the program.
So I wanted to ask you about the origins of this book. That's election night 2016. You're in Kyoto, and you wrote, this book is born out of a combination of political anxiety and jet lag. You said that if you'd been able to hug your friends that night, you might not have written this. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that the election was very disturbing to me, and I had this weird situation where I had to be very polite and very happy because I was being given an award, and you know, my real feelings were churning away underneath and had no one to talk to about them because this was Japan, and you know, I mean, they are concerned with American elections, but not in the way that Americans are. And so, you know, normally if I were at home, I would have been indeed hugging my friends, and instead, I was all by myself, and I could only just sit there in the night. And, you know, as I say, I was somewhat jet-lagged anyway, and just sit there in the night thinking, what is going on in America and what is going on in me? Because I noticed my own outsized fear of the new events, and I thought that out-of-control fear was a problem. And so then I started to think, you know, that I had treated each emotion one by one, and that was just kind of my research program. I would do a book on disgust, a book on anger, and so on. And that was not so good, because actually what I came to see is that I think fear is simmering away beneath it all and is a very infantile emotion in many ways, although, of course, we need to keep some fear around for the things we really care about. But because fear has its origins in infancy, it is really quite a primitive emotion, and it can get out of hand very, very easily. And so it can pollute and distort the other emotions, such as anger and envy and disgust and so on. So I began to think I have to think more relationally, because that's the only thing that does justice to what I'm experiencing in myself and what I'm seeing in other people. And I just finished a book on anger 2 years before, but I began to think that even that did not actually go deep enough, because it didn't see how a sense of powerlessness and a fear connected with a sense of one's own powerlessness often quickly pivots into a kind of ferocious anger that tries to seize control by blaming other people.
So, Martha, do you think, you mentioned fear, do you think that fear is out of hand right now in when we're talking about America 2018?
I do. I think, of course, as I say, I think we need to have some fear of things that are really dangerous, because we wouldn't care about them enough to ward them off if we didn't have fear. I think that, you know, Winston Churchill told people that they needed to have blood, toil, tears and sweat. And that really is saying these are really bad things that we have to fight against. And so that was a kind of rational appeal to fear that said, look, our values are really important. We need to fight to protect them. But what we're getting now is like doomsday thinking. It's on both sides, I think, that people who are anti-Trump think, oh, God, this is the end of America. It's fascism. It's the end of civilization. And, I mean, it's not like we shouldn't think carefully about what this is and how we should ward off the bad tendencies. But doomsday thinking really just doesn't help us. And on the other side, of course, the whole appeal of Trump is based on fear. It's not like we have problems facing technological change, automation, outsourcing. No, it's all immigrants did this, and we have to build a wall. And of course, the whole symbolic appeal of this wall, which isn't even a very rational solution to the immigration problem, is all about fear. We have to just protect ourselves from this looming other that's out there that wants to do us harm. And so, yeah, I mean, I look at the rhetoric of fear used by Trump, and I contrast it with other people, even George W. Bush after 9/11, who was very, very worried that Americans would quickly demonize all Islam and all Muslims, and again and again, and he even created an archive to point out how often he said this. He said, we're not at war with Muslims, we're not at war with Islam, we want to track down and convict certain particular criminals. So he was, you know, aware that fear could easily run away with us, and he tried to contain it, and I think that was what a responsible politician will do.
You mentioned President Trump. I think he kind of looms in the background of this book. And it's interesting because I do think of politicians, and I'm thinking about the 2016 election, not just Donald Trump, but also Bernie Sanders, sort of framing life a little bit as a zero-sum game, that others are taking things away from you. Do you think that most politicians do that these days, reduce things down to sort of a zero-sum game and thinking of life that way?
Well, I don't think most do it. And yeah, I think you're right that there was that ingredient in Sanders. I think he's a very complicated figure, and a lot of the things he said were correct. But yeah, I mean, he doesn't even state the point that we need economic growth in order to have the wherewithal to redistribute and solve our problems. So yeah, I think he fed a kind of irrational demonization of the wealth creation part of our society. So what politicians could do, though, is something quite different. I talk in the book about Roosevelt and how he tried to calm fear in the Depression and say, you know, we need to work together. We need to think about what basic entitlements we all have. But, you know, I think there are plenty of people in our country today who are, in fact, doing that. I mean, I know some of them, people in the political process in my own city. It was just after the book came out, Bill Foster called me up, the congressman from the North Shore. And, you know, he's one of those people, just to give you one example. I mean, he's a scientist. He was a physicist at Fermilab, and he thinks very calmly about problems of technological change and how we're going to solve them. And he's very successful in that small district. Now, of course, the question is, on the national scene, can someone like that actually survive? Look at somebody like John Kasich, who I think of the Republicans was the most, you know, the most appealing and the most reasonable, and he still is. He just didn't quite make it. And look at his partner in the healthcare thing that he tried to put together, an alternative healthcare bill, John Hickenlooper, who I think is the governor of Colorado, one of the best Democrats in the whole business, very funny, calm. I mean, his whole appeal is based on brotherhood and humor and we'll solve our problems together and so on. I think those people are great, and I would love to have Hickenlooper running. There are plenty of other people I can think of, too. I like Mitch Landrieu, who has some of the same qualities. But, you know, there's something about people right now that's a little bit hysterical. And are they going to be able to get behind somebody, not on the local level, which they certainly can do, but on the national level? I'm a little worried about that.
My guest is philosopher Martha C. Nussbaum. She teaches in both the philosophy, she's appointed in both the philosophy and the law school at the University of Chicago. And we're talking about her new book that's called The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. And Martha, I think everybody, no matter where you come from on the political spectrum, you're probably trying to figure out what's going on in the U.S. today. And you come at this as a philosopher, and I wonder how you think philosophy can help us understand the current situation that we're in.
Yeah, well, of course, my philosophy career has two quite different parts, although they join together in a way. One is to try to think about the structure of the emotions, what they contribute to human life, how they can go wrong. And so I've worked on that for a long time, and the book is mostly in that realm. But the other thing that I've done as a political philosopher is to think about what a just society is, what abilities, what opportunities it would make available to all its citizens. So I get into that at the end of the book when I talk about hope, what we should be actually resolving to do now, because I think you don't get out of fear and into something better without having some concrete set of realizable goals. So then I talk about my own approach, which is called the capabilities approach. It talks about basic opportunities that everyone should have. But I think, there are many different ways of talking about a decent society. Mine is just one. So my main conclusion in that part of the book is that we should be thinking about this in a positive sense, because like one of my great heroes in the book, Martin Luther King Jr., who was a real philosopher, he thought that people would not move beyond their immediate pain and anger unless you gave them a vision of hope that they could attach themselves to, a kind of idea of brotherhood that they could envisage. And it was often very close. He didn't think we have to wait for the millennium, but he would say, one day down there in Alabama, little black boys and little black girls will be able to hold hands together as sisters and brothers. So something that simple. And actually, just before my book went to press, Doug Jones won in Alabama, thanks to a large turnout of African-American voters. So it said, stop the press, I want to put that in, because it shows you that King was right to talk about something that could happen. Only it's of course a lot of years later, it's almost 50 years later, but anyway, it did happen, and Alabama is a different place than it was when he was talking. So I think we need hope for something concrete, and that a picture of a good society gives us something to harness our hope too. So philosophers can help us with that too.
Dr. King is a perfect example, as is also Mandela. People who could have been angry and people who could have sought revenge for things that had been done to them, but instead took another route. And I think your dissection of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech is an example of this. And I'm particularly interested in the part where you talk about how Dr. King said, we have come to cash a check, and even the language and construction of that. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, let me step back a minute to say that King did not reject the whole of anger, and neither do I. He thought, as do I, that it has two parts. There's the protest part, where you say a wrong has been done, and that's outrageous, it better not happen again. And then there's the what you rightly call the revenge part, the payback part, that says, let's just inflict pain and misery on the people who perpetrated that. And so he thought that people came to his movement with that confused mixture of emotions, and he said their anger has to be purified and channelized, so they have to get rid of this payback part, the idea that just an eye for an eye makes things better. So anyway, yes, so what he does, he talks about, of course, the horrible outrages of segregation and the wrongfulness of it. And then he suddenly says that we're here to cash a check, that America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check that has come back marked insufficient funds. Now, that's sort of weird, because it's a metaphor you wouldn't have expected. You might expect something much more retributive, but that's exactly what he doesn't want to do. He wants to calm you down and think, okay, there's a debt that's got to be paid. But in order for the debt to be paid, of course, you're not going to murder the debtor. You actually want to figure out a way of working together. And that's what he's building up to. And so then, of course, he goes on to say, we refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity in this nation. So what we're going to do is open the vault and find the opportunities that have been sealed up in this vault.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with University of Chicago philosopher Martha C. Nussbaum. We're talking about her new book. It's just out this summer. It's called The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Martha C. Nussbaum. She's a prolific writer. Her most recent book is called The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. Martha, in the book, you go back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, and you have a lot of that, of not just the Socratic influence, but you're talking about different philosophers. And I thought it was interesting, the notion that they believed that anger was poisonous to democratic politics. Why was that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting difference. We can just see how different cultures are. It's not like, of course, they didn't have a huge anger problem the way we do, but they saw it as a problem. Like the first word of Homer's Iliad is anger, and right away you get that brought thousandfold pains upon the Achaeans. And the whole story of the Iliad is that Achilles has caused this 10-year horrible pain for both sides by his petulant revenge-taking. And then in the end, he has to be reconciled with his enemy Priam, as both join together in lamenting the fragility of human life. So basically, the Greeks and Romans thought that anger is all around us, but it's childish. It's womanish, since they thought women were low. So, and you know, so they thought that we should get on top of it and we shouldn't allow society to be run by anger.
And how do you think that's so different today, especially, and you write about this, the rise of hate crimes that we've seen, particularly in the past couple of years, this notion of anger and revenge, and also there's another emotion in here, envy, that you talk about as well. How do you think those are all related to what we're seeing today?
I think there is a background cultural problem, which is that anger in America particularly has been very strongly linked with male self-assertion, the whole tradition of depictions of the manly man is often the manly man is the one who will get angry and take revenge in defense of his family and his own. When you have a hero who's more compassionate, like Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, it's a real surprise. It's kind of like a, oh, is that really a man? You know, and so America has this problem of a very gendered understanding, which psychologists have shown translates into a way of talking to infants and dealing with their emotions. So, like, there are these baby labeling experiments where if you have the same baby, but you label it male and it's crying, people will say things like, oh, he really is angry. He wants to get what he's due or something. And then if it's labeled as a little girl, they say, oh, poor thing. You know, she's terribly frightened. It's the same baby crying. But of course, over time, that translates into different ways of handling the child. So we have this bigger cultural problem. And then in this particular time when people feel so much powerlessness and fear, it's very natural to suppose that you regain your lost control through anger. It's like, oh, I'm feeling pain. Let's scapegoat somebody, immigrants, women, whatever, and then we'll inflict pain on them. Now, as for envy, the great philosopher, my teacher, John Rawls, wrote in A Theory of Justice that envy is one of the most dangerous emotions for any kind of democracy, because what it is you want to spoil the enjoyment of the haves. So you want, you know, if somebody has the good things in life and you don't have them, you don't just want to have them yourself. That would be okay, but you just want to spoil their enjoyment. And that can be very destructive. Then Rawls says, well, under what circumstances does envy become a problem? It becomes a problem when people feel a kind of helplessness and despair. Now, philosophically, I myself go back also to Lucretius, the Roman philosopher, who said he thought that all envy was an outgrowth of fear, because it's precisely because people don't feel secure in themselves and they feel powerless, the powerlessness, that they grasp after envy. I talk about how I think the musical Hamilton dramatizes this in a most brilliant way, that at the founding we had both things. We had Hamilton who, you know, he was concerned about status, of course, but he really wanted to do something good and to create something. And here is Burr, and I think it's not just the Burr in the musical, but it probably is the Burr in history, who really didn't have anything great that he wanted to do. He just wanted to be rescued from this place of outsiderness and darkness. That brilliant song, The Room Where It Happens, he just sees that something's going on in that room.
He just wants to be in that room, right?
He just wants to be in that room. And so this bitter envy, and he wants to spoil Hamilton's life. And of course, he does succeed in doing that. But all out of a kind of negative, simmering cauldron of emotions based on his own fear and powerlessness.
Of course, Martha, we don't do any of this consciously. And so I wanted to ask you about that, because I think envy is perhaps one we're maybe the least consciously aware of. All of these emotions, fear, anger. I wonder, as a society, how you think we can manage these things if most of these emotions are unconscious, or if we're not realizing that it's happening.
Well, I think self-examination can make them conscious. You don't have to go to a psychoanalyst, although I love psychoanalysis, but, you know, you just thinking about yourself in an ordinary way, you were talking to your friends. But I also think it's on two sides. So, look, if people individually are worried about their own emotions, there are lots of things that I mention in the book that they could do. Join a protest movement that's trying to do something good, get involved in a political campaign. The arts, religion, all kinds of aspects of community can address the personal side of the emotions. But the flip side is, what can we do to make this a society in which people just don't have that insecurity? Now, Roosevelt, I think, was a genius at seeing that there was the New Deal is really all about how can we make a society in which people do not feel crippling fear. And yeah, I mean, he to a large extent did that. And I think now, for example, Americans feel terrible, terrible fear of a medical crisis, being without insurance. I've had that in my own family. You know, and it's amazing how terrifying it is to think, oh my God, all my life savings will be wiped out. So we need to work on that, because that's one way, as Roosevelt very well knew, by having a good social safety net, you take fear out of people's daily lives. And then they don't have to have envy. If everyone has the good things in life, well, then you don't have to worry about who has more of them. And somehow, if everyone has at least a certain amount, then the fact that somebody might have a little more doesn't become as bad. It doesn't loom over you in the same way.
And part of this is also your attitude. And I just wanted to end by asking you about what you say towards the end of the book, that hope is a habit. How do you think we can develop hope as a habit?
Well, what I mean is that hope is really sort of the same as fear, because both involve the thought that you're insecure, that things could change, there could be a good outcome, there could be a bad outcome. And so actually the Stoics thought the only way to get rid of fear is to get rid of hope too. But of course I don't want to get rid of either of them completely. But then it's sort of like seeing the glass as half full rather than half empty. It's a difference of perspective and emphasis, but it makes a huge difference, because the hopeful perspective gets you going. It energizes you to try to undertake good efforts that'll make the good outcome more likely to happen. Kant said that for that reason, we have a duty to practice hope, because he said, look, we're obligated to do good in the world, but if we can't do good in the world without thinking that it might actually be good or work out somehow, then we have to get ourselves in the habit of hoping. Now, I happen to be a very hopeful person. I guess part of it is being female and seeing the tremendous progress that women have made since I was a child, when women couldn't go to any of the major universities. Still a lot of problems, but you know, just the trajectory worldwide is pretty amazing. But I think there are different ways that people can nourish hope in themselves. I do think that one really is religion. In Chicago, the churches, as I'm sure you know, have been beacons of hope to people who otherwise would have lives that are really bereft of hope. And we have terrible, terrible problems. But the fact that these two very successful nonviolent protest marches against violence have both been led by pastors who had a great following. Father Flager in particular, I think, has a huge practice of hope. I mean, he's constantly doing different things, concerts, marches, and so on, to generate hope. So, you know, whatever your situation is, whatever your community is, you have to figure out, what can I do now to get more involved in things that are hopeful? Then you feel useful, and you feel that what you're doing might possibly bear fruit.
That's Martha C. Nussbaum. Martha, thanks for being with us. She teaches at University of Chicago, and her most recent book is The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Nyla. I really enjoyed it.
If you're not someone who follows comics regularly, you might think that most of it consists of superheroes you see at the movie theater. But comics have been part of American society for a long time, and they touch on all parts of life, just like books or movies do, whether that's stories of superheroes, but also topics like history and politics. Today, the University of Illinois is hosting its first ever Comic Studies Society Conference. It's being held at the U of I School of Information Sciences, and their community day happening right now is free and open to the public. Two of the authors who will be there actually worked on a graphic novel adaptation of one of my favorite books of all time. That's Kindred by Octavia Butler. And they're both joining us here on the 21st. Damian Duffy is a lecturer at the U of I and adapted the novel. John Jennings, a former U of I professor, illustrated the book and now teaches at University of California at Riverside. Carol Tilley's also with us. She's president of the Comic Studies Society and an associate professor at the U of I School of Information Sciences. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So before we get to Kindred and this adaptation, Carol, I just wanted to start by asking you about the Comic Studies Society. Can you explain what you all do?
Sure, absolutely. In the 1920s and 30s, there were certainly folks who studied comics as a scholarly pursuit, but it wasn't really until the 1980s and 90s that comic studies started to become a thing that people felt free within the university context to explore. And the Comic Studies Society came about 3 years ago, and it is the first scholarly society that is member-supported, that's international, that focuses solely on comic scholarship, but also reaches out to practitioners and cartoonists and librarians and archivists. And what we do, we celebrate all kinds of inquiry around comics broadly, whether that's cartooning or graphic novels or comic books throughout the world.
Carol, I wonder if you can answer why you think it's important for people to take comics seriously as a field of study, because I think a lot of people listening might think, why are people studying comic books?
I think for a long time, comics had an unfair association of being juvenile. And I think that's inaccurate. And that's one of the things in my research that I'm trying to tease apart is who was reading comics and what does that readership look like over the decades. But I think that there was this idea that comics were sort of a subculture, that they were too juvenile and kid-focused, and they weren't really worthy of academic consideration. And now we see people applying comics in all kinds of situations, from medicine and lab science and mental health to all sorts of public policy and other kinds of situations. And it's really important, I think, for a lot of us who grew up maybe reading comics and have grown into studying them as a scholarly pursuit to help people see that comics, yes, are Batman and Robin and Superman and Wonder Woman.
But also, I'm thinking History, March Absolutely. By John Lewis, which has been an award-winning graphic novel adaptation of a historic civil rights moment, is another way that people are maybe coming to that story.
Absolutely. And I often tell people that, for me, I see comics as an integral part of our cultural heritage here. They are a means of telling stories, of conveying information, and they're just as important as any other mode of communication.
And I wonder if you all think that, and I don't know if this is different from other forms of literature, but if you think comic books and graphic novels have particularly been more open to diverse voices and perspectives in a way that maybe we haven't seen in literature, or would you disagree? Damon, you're making a face.
I both agree and disagree. Agree in the sense that what is traditionally in the U.S. referred to as the comics industry has been as backwards in issues of diversity as any sort of other entertainment industry. But there were underground comics that were just like people in the 60s, like selling them through like head shops, right? Like there's comics that are on the web now. Like, because comics is such a broad field and there are so many different types of work being put out, it's hard to make generalizations like that anymore.
Damon's absolutely right. I mean, it's something that what is called the mainstream comics industry, which we were talking about, is like the direct market, you know, with the superheroes, is actually quite a niche market, really. I mean, you know, there's, of course, superheroes are mainstream now mostly because of the films, but, you know, it's the immediacy of the medium itself that I think really gets into the idea of how multiple voices can do it. Damon just mentioned like the underground comics movement. But it's also like been like these countercultural movements. We've been looking at a lot of course, like the Black independent comics movement and also the Latinx comics movement as well that's been happening. And this is basically, you know, a lot because of the ubiquitous nature of the tools that you make comics with now, too. So yeah, I would say yes, there has been some growth in the idea of representation, but traditionally in the mainstream comics like superheroes and stuff, it's been kind of touch and go.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation about comics and comic studies. We'll also get to the award-winning graphic novel adaptation of Kindred by Octavia Butler. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, you've been hearing our conversation about comics and comic studies. The U of I is actually hosting its first ever Comic Studies Society conference. Their community day is today, and it's free and open to the public. We're talking to three guests who will be at that community day. Carol Tilley is president of the Comic Studies Society and an associate professor at the U of I School of Information Sciences. Damian Duffy and John Jennings worked on a graphic novel adaptation of the book Kindred by Octavia Butler, which happens, by the way, to be one of my all-time favorite books. Both Damian and John also have their own academic careers at the U of I and UC Riverside, respectively. Their adaptation won an Eisner Award. That's kind of like the Oscars for comics, and they both told me that winning that award felt surreal. I caught up with them earlier this week. We spent the rest of our conversation talking about what it was like to turn Octavia Butler's writing into a graphic novel, and I asked Damian to remind us about Kindred.
So Kindred, published 1979, and I think it's Butler's definitely highest-selling work. So probably most well-known. It's the story of Dana Franklin, who is an African-American woman in the 1970s, who starts being inexplicably pulled back to the antebellum South, to a slave plantation in Maryland, where she starts to figure out that she has ancestors on the plantation, both among the slaves and the slave owners. Butler called it a grim fantasy because there's no real science to the science fiction aspect. Like, there's no time
machine.
Well,
there's also a little bit of, it's also a little bit of a horror in a way.
That's what I was,
what Dana goes through.
Yeah. No, it's actually, it's probably one of the most horrific books I've ever read, and that's probably one of the reasons I was so excited to be able to adapt it. John and I, we definitely approached it as horror, and especially gothic horror.
John?
Oh, I was about to say, and we did win a horror award for the Bram Stoker Award as well.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
So
yeah. Let me start with you, John. How intimidating was it to have Octavia Butler's works? And I have to say, you know, when everyone reads something, I had a picture of what Dana, you know, everybody has pictures of what everybody looks like Dana and Rufus. I had kind of pictures in my head of what I thought they would be. How tough is that to take on as an illustrator?
I mean, I think it's, when I look at illustration, I mean, it's just another form of problem solving, you know. I think from a design standpoint, it was very daunting, not only because it's hard to illustrate something that actually is being described by someone, but also you think Beyonce fans are really protective. Oh, my goodness. The fans
Octavia Butler. Absolutely. I can understand that.
They are very, very protective of the work. So that's that pressure as well. I will say this, though. Damian and I had a chance to go and speak at the Huntington Library, and they did a special presentation on Kindred. And on the table were a lot of the original scripts and notes that she had. And so they had this manila folder that actually had two images of a white man who looked like a Marlboro ad, right, Damian?
Yeah, it was some kind of cigarette ad. It was definitely
Kind of cigarette ad. And then these are from the 70s. And then there was this lovely black woman with like short cropped hair. And so when we saw them, we immediately knew that was Kevin and Dana. So what they were showing us were the references for them. And we actually got pretty close. Very daunting. But, you know, I think if you pay attention to the text, and we read it many, many times to try to get the feel right, that it becomes easier. You know, but I think most of the pressure came from the fact that this had never been really done before, and that if we failed, then it could be really massive. So, like, that was a lot of that. You know?
Yeah, our goal was to not mess up. That was pretty much
exactly.
It.
Exactly. It was like, if we could get someone to not hate the book, I think that was what we were shooting for.
Damian, would you find it particularly intimidating doing the adaptation side of the words?
Yes. Yeah, I had a lot of trouble with early drafts of the script cutting things because, like, who am I to cut Octavia Butler's prose? I mean, in our contract, there's a page count already, so it has to fit in that page count. So I ended up having to cut things, although our editor, Sheila Keenan, was really a great help in that. But also, the same things John was talking about, I was definitely, while writing it, I felt like Octavia Butler's spirit was over me, like, no, white boy, stop, this is terrible. What are you doing?
Don't do it.
I think I finally sort of got over that when we met Octavia's cousin, and she was, like, very complimentary of the work and liked everything. And I think that was when I breathed a sigh of relief finally, like, oh, we did okay. We did justice to it.
Carol, I wonder if that's in some ways what some of the point of the comics and graphic novel, graphic adaptation world is now maybe this is an entire new generation of people who will now encounter Octavia Butler for the first time.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that all of the different kinds of adaptations and the different audiences we can reach, the different formats, all that does is bring in new readers, new people who can learn to appreciate comics and see them both as, you know, maybe the superhero things that they read as a kid, but also something that can be infinitely powerful in a different manner.
And John, to the point that you, the point of diverse perspectives, I wanted to ask you. It's so great. You guys really you had Nnedi Okorafor write the introduction to this, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But it was so interesting to read her experience of encountering Octavia Butler and hearing a voice and someone who looked like her and was writing a story like what she wanted to write. I wonder if you feel like that's also something that's really important with this graphic novel, is it provides a voice and a face for a segment of the population, as we've been talking about, that's not just a white male perspective.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, in so many ways, Octavia Butler was a pioneer and a trailblazer and had a very solitary life, but also was very adamant about seeing herself be successful, literally writing herself into existence as a science fiction writer, becoming the first science fiction writer to earn the MacArthur Genius Grant. I mean, and inspiring many generations to a certain degree of science fiction and fantasy writers who happen to be Black women. You know, Nnedi Okorafor, Nalo Hopkinson, the list goes on and on of people who were her peers and were inspired by her. And I think that, you know, everyone who participates in a society deserves to see themselves to be represented in the space that they participate in. And so she was an avatar for that change. And I think her, her influence, it really is, there's not enough words to talk about just how influential she is. So,
John, before we went on air, you mentioned how prescient much of Octavia Butler's work is to the present day. I wonder what your thoughts are about that with Kindred specifically.
Kindred is still, I think, very relevant because it is dealing with the fact that the wages of slavery to a certain degree are being kind of earned now, you know, in some ways, when you look at the current political climate, by using time travel as kind of a device or a mechanism to talk about those issues, Butler shows us that, you know, we are still very complicit in how racism kind of plays out in different ways systemically in our country. And it's a very powerful metaphor for the connections that actually still bind us. And, you know, basically kind of stating, like, as long as we, you know, kind of sweep that particular conversation under the rug, we still have to deal with the trauma of slavery, because it didn't just affect Black people, it affected white people as well. And that's one of the core kind of allegories that I think that she's trying to get across to us.
I wanted to ask about the role of technology in all of this. I think it's interesting because I actually read graphic novels now because of my iPad, and I wonder how many more people read them now because they can read them electronically. Carol?
The limited surveys that are out there suggest that the digital comics and digitally formatted comics are bringing in a lot more readers, especially among women who may have not wanted to go to their local comic book shop for various reasons. but there are some indications. And certainly readership among kids has bounced back a lot for a variety of reasons.
I just wanted to end by asking all of you how you think everything you've been talking about, Carol, the idea of this being an art form that can be inspiring, also touching, in this case, with the graphic novel adaptation you all have done, on some really deep issues of American society. How do you think graphic novels are handle that differently than a book or another way of writing about this?
That's a tough question. But I think that the biggest element, again, is in that symbiotic relationship between the text and the image. because I think that even with an illustrated book, where you might have photographs or figures along the way, or even in a children's picture book, there's not the richness of information and the rich opportunity for emotional impact that you might get in a really well-done comic. And I think the additional information that you get through the image and the way that the creators control the flow of the story through the panels and guide your attention visually and cognitively, I think that that brings some extra power to comics that may not always be there in other kinds of media. And there's just something very moving about being able to see, whether it's through the eyes of the character or see what the comics creators want you to see and how they're focusing your attention in the story.
Going along with that, I think that a lot of the power in comics is that it's, as an art form or medium or whatever you want to call it, it's exists in between other yes. media and is therefore able to reference other media, to comment upon various other media, because while it's just ink on paper or on a screen, comics can mimic sound, they mimic motion, the style of illustration mimics the subjectivity of the author. And I think because of that, because it's so flexible as information expression, as a storytelling device, that's really the strength of it. That it's a different type of reading that references or connects to other types of reading. So, for example, like with Kindred, I would hope people would read the graphic novel and the novel. That was always like my big goal, because I think there is something rich in comparing and contrasting, and comics is all about juxtaposition. Reading graphic novels, reading comics, it asks your brain to look at things, compare and contrast them in ways I think that are beneficial to like critical thinking.
You know, a lot of times as human beings we think very metaphorically, and comics are inherently surreal and symbolic in nature, so everything can be looked at as different types of symbols, and I think we kind of utilize that symbolic kind of meaning, that symbolic kind of legibility, as ways to kind of infer different things that we really wouldn't see in prose or film, you know, or be able to glean from those mediums, you know, those media in different ways. So I think, yeah, that's another power too, is that the symbolic nature of how comics speak to us, I think kind of put us into this surrealistic kind of dream state, and we can actually, you know, read them differently because of how they kind of put forth the information.
Well, thanks all of you. That's John Jennings, who's the illustrator behind the graphic novel adaptation of Kindred. Damian Duffy is with us as well. He helped adapt the novel. Carol Tilley inspired this conversation because she's the president of the Comic Studies Society. And as we said, their first international conference is happening in Champaign, Urbana. And they have Community Day actually today. We will send out more information. Right now, I just want to thank Carol, Damian, and John for being with me. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. 21stShow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.